take.
I'm gonna let him take two, just in case the battery goes down.
Mike was a big.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's the great privilege of the REITs Israel Kollel Visiting Shir Committee, which has been established in 5769, that we welcome Herb Nassim Kamenetsky, who will deliver some off-the-cuff comments. Not really sure about what yet, but we'll see soon. Rav Kamenetsky, as most of us know, recently published an article in the Sefer Zevetov in honor of Rabbi Chalap about the relationship between Rav David Lifshitz and former Sephardi Chief Rabbi Harav Yitzchak Nissim. And as some people might know as well, Rav Kamenetsky recently published an article in Kovetz Kedushin Torah somewhere, but also in he published a book called Making Megadol, and he has a first edition, he has an updated and improved edition. And just in case anybody says that the improved edition is a censored edition, you should just know that on page 1427 to 1429, he lists several dozen comments and corrections of everything that he corrected and elaborated upon, new sources, new understandings, omitted. So that's with censorship like that, I think we can all agree that that's very much enjoyed. Anyways, I'm not really sure what Kamenetsky is going to talk about, but it's our privilege to welcome him to the REITs Israel Kollel.
As the announcement said, this is an off-the-cuff presentation. So not only does Menachem not know what I'll talk about, I don't either. But the last thing that, as was mentioned here, was a story that Nesanel tells from his grandfather, when he was vacationing in Hunter, New York, he overheard his family would have their cottage next to the Baum Kotler's cottage. And one day he heard someone reading Gemara with the regular Yeshivisha sing song, and he's kind of like a young boy, so he didn't want to see who it was who was singing the Gemara so beautifully. So he looked over the fence and he saw that it was Rebbetzin, the Rebbetzin of Aaron Kotler. Now this is a big chiddush to me, that she knew how to learn Gemara. But I imagine she held like Benazai. Benazai holds that a woman is mechuyev in Talmud Torah. And I'll say at this moment, when I walked in before, I hadn't seen Menachem since he arrived in Israel, so I asked him if anyone called him Benazai, and the Hamevin Yavim, I want to call him Benazai. Hamevin Yavim. Right. Now, regarding this, let me say something. I was just asked not to speak about the band.
But anyone is interested in more about the band,
yeah.
There are shirim from Flatbush, Ramat Beit Shemesh, which are all available on
okay.
MP3 in case
okay.
people like.
Now, I just want to say, relating to what I was just told, that one of the things that was bothering the people that read my book, incidentally, as Menachem said, it's not called, it's an improved edition, but not a censored one. When I told my brother-in-law, Dr. Chaim Waxman, who is a YU graduate, and he's a musmach of YU too, someone mentioned before that he knows my nephew Ari Waxman, that's his father, is my brother-in-law. So when I told him I'm going to publish an improved edition, so he recalled that in the Yiddish newspapers of old, before the Allgemeine Journal, which is the only Yiddish weekly, I think, that exists now in New York, I'd like to mention that soon too. The three newspapers were the Vorwärts, which is translated into Kadima, and the Der Tag, and the Morgen Journal, the Day and the Morning Journal. Those are the three newspapers then. And I was asked recently, which newspaper did my father read? My father read the Morgen Journal, and Rav Moshe Feinstein also read the Morgen Journal. And don't believe when you read Rav Moshe never opened the newspaper. He used to read it every day. Every day. So far, his books that say the truth. When my brother-in-law told me that when the Yiddish newspapers saw it as their obligation to educate the Jewish masses, especially the Fovas, educate them toward socialism, and the Tog, which was the Bund. Now the Morgen Journal was less educational. Why? Because the Morgen Journal was run by people belonging to Mizrahi, so they knew the Jewish people had to be educated with Torah and mitzvahs. So there wasn't much to add to that. But the other newspapers felt that they had to educate the masses. And once one of the Yiddish newspapers was starting to print a translation of Shakespeare, so they called it Verteicht und Verbessert. Shakespeare translated into Yiddish and improved. So this is the way my book will be improved. But I pointed out to him that since I published the book, new things came up. So it was actually improved. And one of the things that I added, this I want to go to Lubavitch because something that I saw this Shabbos, one of the things that I improved it is that in my first edition I write about the Sri Deish, Reb Weinberg, Reb Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, who was childless, and about Reb Shaul Lieberman, who was childless, and I mentioned Samuel Atlas. Now they were Tamidei Chachamim, and of course the Sri Deish was one of the Gdeila Hador, you could call him. But yet he writes very in something that Professor Shapiro published, his exchange of letters with Samuel Atlas, where you see that he doesn't see any future for Klal Yisrael and all that. It's unbelievable that an Orthodox Rav should write such things. You can look it up in Mark Shapiro's book. Anyway, so I write there that for someone who doesn't have children, he doesn't have a personal stake in posterity, he can act irresponsibly. Of course, the Chazon Ish had no children either, but he had his emunah u'bitachon. But otherwise, let's say the same fault that was found to be in the Sri Deish was in Shaul Lieberman, because he had no children. So he took a position with the conservatives. And Samuel Atlas took a position with the reformers. Because they didn't expect to have children. They will not have children. So therefore, they can do things which l'achameh ve'esrim of theirs, they don't care what happens. I wrote that, and someone told me, maybe it was Dr. Shapiro, I remember somebody told me, that for the whole 1,500 pages of the book, this insight made the whole book worthwhile. This was rough in the original edition. In the improved edition, I added something. I added on page, that I wrote on page 820. And then I wrote on page 834, what's that?
It was page 820.
Which? You knew which page it was? Yeah. Maybe you're the one that told me that the book was worth it for this insight. But anyways, I wrote over there, I'd like to read you what I wrote. Apropos, page 820 above, another manifestation of recklessness on the part of childless leaders may be the legacy of messianic confusion bequeathed to his chassidim by the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. This is, I added in the improved edition. I was attacked by the Lakewood crowd, but not by the Lubavitchers. Yeah. Anyways, so I just came across this Shabbos, something here. Maybe you've seen this. This is from Lubavitch. So he writes over here, the editor of the Allgemeine Journal is Gershon Jacobson. He's a Lubavitch. It's a Lubavitch newspaper, a weekly in Yiddish. I'm not sure if it's still in existence now. I presume it is. And so he writes here that in 1968, now this is what this throwaway writes. In 1968, right after this, I don't know why he writes 1968. In the days after the Six-Day War, it should be 1967, but perhaps it was a year later, when in the world is still echoed the miraculous victory of Israel. So Gershon Jacobson, he's the editor of the Allgemeine Journal, decided he's going to visit, he'll visit Egypt. So he got a visa to enter Egypt. He was going, of course, as a tourist, as a newspaper man. And one day he gets a telephone call from one of the senior people in the Mossad. "I want to warn you," he said, "from this idea of going to Egypt. It's a crazy plan in these days. They're not good. The Egyptians are not going to hesitate to do something to you. For as they would any Jew who's a foreign citizen who steps into the country. Don't go to Egypt." He listened carefully, but he said, "I can't decide for myself. I'm going to ask the Lubavitcher Rebbe." So after several hours, he says somebody else called him, somebody from the Yediot Achronot, the newspaper world in Israel, with the same, he told him, trying to beg him not to dare go to Egypt. The next opportunity, he went into the Lubavitcher Rebbe and told him. So the Rebbe said, "You can go, but you have to do three things. One thing, when you get to Egypt, you have to check into the most expensive hotel. The second thing you have to do is immediately make telephone calls to the ambassador, all the ambassadors of the countries, of foreign countries, and schedule with them interviews. And the third thing, buy as many as you can picture postcards and send them all over the world to your friends in many countries." And the Rebbe asked him, this already is a Lubavitch, this is not what I want to bring out, ask him before he leaves. He should step into him. He wants to send along a package with him. And quite the package he sent along was a chalef for a shechita and a pair of tefillin. And he tells us when he got to Egypt, he went to visit the Jewish community. So the sheikha told him that his sakan, there's only one sheikha there, and the sakan became spoiled, doesn't know what to do. So he pulled out this present from Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rav told him that his tefillin was rejected, and it turned out to be posel, the parsha inside. And the sefer is the one sefer who's there happens to be sitting in jail, so he pulled out this. But this I'll put aside. Now, so this is what he did. Jacobson did he took the advice of the chassid of the Rebbe, and as soon as he got there, he checked in and everything else, and he wrote postcards. Whom did he send? Tal the Lubavitcher Shluchim all over the world. He sent picture postcards, and he contacted all the foreign ambassadors. As a matter of fact, he says that the Canadian ambassador to Egypt became very friendly with him, and he used to travel with him wherever he went. The visit ended, and Jacobson decided he's going to visit Israel. So he went by way of a third country, and he got to Israel. And the next morning, the Yediot Achronot had a headline, "Jacobson returns from a visit in Egypt," with a picture of Jacobson riding on a camel with the pyramids in the background. Okay. Now, and then he was asked, what kind of, what an ingenious idea you had. And he was, this was who's out from the Mossad again, calling him. Where'd you get this ingenious idea? You should know the Egyptians had plans prepared that they're going to arrest you within a fortnight, within a day from the time you enter Egypt, and they're going to put you in jail on trumped up charges. So where'd you get this idea? The idea of contacting the foreign dignitaries and sending postcards all over the world. They thought you had your world personality. Where'd you get this idea? So of course he gave credit to none other but the Rebbe. So this is inside. But I just want to bring out this point. The Rebbe gave me excellent ideas. This I believe. The Rebbe was a very, very wise man. Which brings us to the point, if he was so wise, he must have figured out what his propaganda with his chassidim will bring about. The more wise he was, the greater we have the question, the bigger the question becomes, how did he bequeath this messianic confusion to his chassidim? Now, I was in England, this already doesn't appear. I told you, things constantly come up about what I wrote in the book, so something came up after this was published, already the improved edition. I visited England, and I went to visit Abba Duner, Rabbi Abba Duner. He's the secretary of the Conference of European Rabbonim.
Pinny's a son.
You know him, Benazza.
I know Pinny.
What's that? You know him?
No, son Pinny.
Ah, Pinny. Anyway, I went to visit him, so I told him about this insight, that I, without children, are irresponsible. So he told me something that I would have added into the book. Someone told him, I don't know how reliable it's, because it was a Satma Chosid, Satma have it against Lubavitch, of course. Satma told him that the sister of the Rebbetzin, of the Lubavitch Rebbetzin, Chayamushka, so she was asked by her sister, Mrs. Gurarye. She was asked, how does your husband keep speaking about Mashiach when he was still alive? If he's going to die, what's going to happen? So she went to ask her husband. So she brought back the answer to her sister, the words of Louis XVI. The Lubavitch Rebbe answered, Après moi le déluge. Acharai hamabul. In other words, mamish exactly. I was mechav lamito shel Lubavitch Torah, and this after me. What do I care? After me, come let the mabul come. This is what he told me. This I would have added to prove that I was right in my estimation. Anyways, I want to get back to something else that I found out. Concerning something for which I was criticized, I had written that the Rabban Kotler wrote to his fiancée, they weren't married, he wrote a letter, he was writing from Sabotka and she was living in Slutsk. I'm not sure he was writing from Sabotka because before he got married he went to Radin, he went to Nevada, he went to other yeshivas too, but he was writing a letter to Slutsk, to his Kala, and Rabbi Salzalman didn't like what he wrote. So he showed the letter to the altar of Sabotka, who of course was involved in the Shidduch. Bacha like Rabban Kotler was running in Sabotka then. So in order to get Rabban Kotler as a husband for his daughter, to get a son-in-law like Rabban Kotler, it had to go through the altar of Sabotka. Incidentally, Rebbe Shulman told me that she remembers that she was a little girl when Rebbe Salzalman came when Rabbi Sal Zalman came to ask the Alter of Slabodka to give him his Talmud Rabban Kotler as a son-in-law, so she remembered that how he was sitting, and then her mother was Rebbe Sasher, Rebbe Sasholman's, who passed away in Bnei Brak. She was Ramotka Shulman's wife. So she was a little girl then. She was maybe 5 years old, and she remembers that the way that they were sitting, and her mother asked her father, the Alter of Slabodka, Rebbe Sasholman was a granddaughter of the Alter of Slabodka. She asked him, you're giving away Aaron Sislavichev? You're giving away Aaron Kotler? So he answered her, what do you mean I'm giving him away? Rabbi Zalman is more dear to me than your brother, Rabbi Lezer Yudel Finkel. Listen, that's what he said then. So she when she heard it, she was 5 years old, but she said, this I have to remember. And she remained with this memory until she told it to him scores of years later. So she told me this story. Anyways, he came to ask for Rabban's hand, and the Alter of Slabodka approved it. So later, when she was engaged already, when she received this letter from her fiancé, Rabban, he showed it to the Alter. So the Alter said, look, I didn't say that he was a tzaddik. I said he had other milas, but he'll become so frum that the whole world will suffer from his frumkeit. This is what the Alter said. I bring it out, not concerning Rabban Kotler, just to show how the Alter of Slabodka was able to evaluate each person and foresee what he will be in the future. I cite many cases where we foresaw the future of his Talmidim. Anyways, so of course, the ones who are out to get me, so I wrote that he wrote a love letter to his Kala and everything else. I never thought anybody would read that I wrote a love letter. And then I, it's a very simple, if a girl gets a love letter if love letters were written in those days, I'm speaking back in 1910 or 1911, if love letters were written, which girl would show a love letter that she received from a cousin to her father? The girl would show that. And the Sazam would certainly not open his daughter's mail. So I never imagined that anybody would misread what I wrote. In the improved edition, I wrote, when the person told him over the story, he didn't tell me over what was in the letter, and he himself didn't know what was in the letter. I'll soon get something that I received from Rabbi Avi Shulman, who's a Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshiva Chavetz Chaim. I received that letter after I had written my improved edition. Anyways, in the improved edition, I wrote what I assume was in the letter. Because in another part of the book, I mentioned that Rebbe Sasholman told me that there was a time of the week when Bokhrim would say Chaburas. Each Bokhrim had something in the Torah to say. It must be in a different corner of the Bis Medrash. Another Bokhrim would come to listen to him. Like they're having yeshivas nowadays too. Chabura. It's supposed to be Chabura, but people say Chabura. Okay. So she told me that when Rabban Kotler said a Chabura, all the Bachim would go to him, to no one else. All the Bachim would pile around to hear what he has to say. So I said, I imagine he wrote to her, yesterday I said a Chabura, and everybody came over to listen to me, to nobody else. This is something she'd be very proud of. And she'd show it to her father. Rabbi Sal Zalman, the tzaddik, would say, he has to write that he's better than everybody else. And on that, Rabbi Sal Zalman, the Alter of Slabodka told him, I didn't say he was a tzaddik. If he'd be a tzaddik, he wouldn't have written that. All right. This is what I wrote in the improved edition. I suggest that this is what he wrote. Sometime later, I receive a letter from Avi Shulman. Rabbi Avi Shulman. He's a Rosh Yeshiva, isn't he? Shulman.
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Rabbi Shulman. So he writes to me that Rishel Kotler, the daughter of Rabban Kotler, told her that when Rabban was a chosn, he wrote to her mother-in-law, this is Rabbi Shneur Kotler's wife, who's reporting this, and she's telling this to Avi Shulman. And she's saying that her mother-in-law told her that when she was a kalet to Rabban Kotler, he wrote her a letter which her father didn't like. What did he write in the letter? He wrote her a list of Russian books she should read. Now, I raise my hands in gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this letter came to me after I published it. Because had I received that, I would have had to write the truth. So I would have written that. And then I would have gotten into serious trouble. But anyways, it's a chiddush to me that Rebbes and Kotler, I thought she read Russian literature, but now I hear that she learned Gemara too. But in this story that she was learning Gemara during the summer in Hanukkah, this already is a big chiddush to me. Incidentally, I once gave a lecture about women learning Torah. And I brought a very, I asked the Kabbalistic Akasha, the Chofetz Chaim, in his Likutei Halacha, it's Masechet Sota, where it says there, but the woman should not learn Torah. So he writes over there, he writes a whole program, what they should learn, what women should learn. What women should, so it's Akasha to me, well, it says they shouldn't learn. So he's creating, why does he put it into there that the, I mean, why does he give these hatayrim there all of a sudden? And from my father, I heard that the women shouldn't learn Torah was at a time when they didn't learn anything else. But now if they learn limudei chayil, they have to learn Torah in order to counteract the evil influences of the secular studies. So now that's what I heard from my father. But this is a question I asked about the Chofetz Chaim. So I found a remarkable thing in the Maril, in Shuvas Maril. He writes over there, he always says, how did Bruya learn Torah? So he wants to say, maybe she held like Benazai, whatever. But he says a remarkable thing. He says, women are supposed to learn. But the Gemara says women do not learn Torah. It was Eis Lasa Shlashem Eferu Torah Secho. Because essentially they're supposed to learn, but there was a hafora, the hafora of Torah, because of certain considerations. When I read that, I realized Chofetz Chaim, if he's returning the Torah leYoishno, of course it's much easier to say, but this is all right, this is all right, no, this is all right to learn, because the approach is that women don't learn Torah. Is only a later ordinance, a feiroteresecha kind of psak. Right, this is the Siddur Chagav. I'm saying this in relation to the chiddush that I heard just before about from Rabbi Netanel Prera. I'll tell you, Menachem wrote this out. Why was this? Deliver a short off-the-cuff presentation because I had no intention of coming here to speak. I happened to write to Menachem when he sent me in something and all his, if anyone is on his list, he realized how much work goes into each one of his letters.
It's all things.
It's all things. All right, I just like to suggest that perhaps you can make an index of all your mailings, so I can search for things through that index. Anyways, so he mentioned something in there that he once wrote in the Mikhtavim blog is something pertaining to the closure of Volozhin. And I didn't remember that he sent it into me, or perhaps he did send it into me, but I didn't go through it. There's too much material to go through, unfortunately. But I looked at it this time, and I saw over there that he brings something in there from my making of a gadol, and he has some. Where's my tick? You see it? Anyone? No? Because I printed something out from there. You want to see it?
Oh. I see it, yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
So, I saw it in there, in this Mechtavim blog, right? And then, there's of course, I don't know what they call exactly when people
comments.
Write in. What is it called?
Comments.
So one of the comments from Father Ringay Phipps. I don't know who that is. So he writes, and he writes in there about, we're speaking about the reason why Volozhin Yeshiva was closed down. So he writes in here, RNK's speculation. He has no proofs of any sort about the closing being a machination by the Netziv is one of the most disgraceful aspects of his book. This is a comment that you received when you mentioned me that I wrote about the closure of Volozhin. Derech Agav, Shaul Stanford, Dr. Stanford, wrote this, and he writes a whole chapter about the closing of Volozhin. So when he begins the chapter, he writes in a footnote that my book writes a lot about this, very interesting what it writes about this. And throughout that chapter, he mentions things that I wrote about the closure. But when I wrote to Menachem, I said, and I wrote, I responded, I said, I never knew you wrote this. And especially about this, that somebody is attacking me is one of the most disgraceful aspects of his book. Yeah. So I mentioned it. So Menachem, I think, thought that I was indicating that it was his comment. But I, of course, it wasn't. I knew it wasn't his comment. As for Shalom. But since I had this exchange with him, so he already invited me to come and speak. So I said, I'll speak off the cuff. Anyways, he titled it, wasn't my title, From Covenant to New York to Buy It for Gun. So I thought it's speaking about me. I was in Covenant. I was born in Lithuania. I was in Covenant. I lived in Tsitavian, which is a village. Kovna, of course, is the city of which Sabotka is the suburb. So we can call that Kovna, because I was in Sabotka on the way to New York. And then I moved to Toronto and to New York, where, incidentally, I met Nathanael's grandfather, where I learned the Torah with us, to Beit Vagan. Beit Vagan was the first place I lived when I came to Israel. I lived on Rehov Aziel, as a matter of fact. Rented in about Rehov Aziel. Because where I live now wasn't built yet. It was built a year and a half later. So I thought that it means, speaking about me, from Covenant to New York to Beit Vagan. But while I was here, somebody said, maybe I should speak about my father. Well, my father fits in very well too. Covenant to New York to Beit Vagan. Why? Because when he used to come to visit Israel, most of the time he used to stay in Beit Vagan. But I didn't give this matter any thought. So if I speak about myself, if I make a mistake, Mele. But I don't want to make any mistakes about my father. So I'll speak about myself, from Covenant to New York to Beit Vagan. I was in Covenant. I mentioned before the earliest memory of Rebbetzin Shulman. My earliest memory of my whole life took place in Slobodka. I was 3 years old. And I was I was sick. I had bronchitis. And in those years, bronchitis was a very dangerous disease for infants. I'm 3 years old. So from Sitavian, they brought me to Kovna. And my mother nursed me back to health. I remember when she fed me the porridge, she would say, in German, she would say, I don't know how good a German it is, but I'll call it pidgin German. She said, Suppe die Krupe, Kriege die Krafte. Sip the porridge, Suppe die Krupe, then you'll get strength, Kriege die Krafte. I remember Anyways, pertaining to that, I want to tell something here, especially for young parents. For many years afterwards, because I was in mortal danger then, so my parents used to call me Der Gefundener, the found one. Because they thought that I wasn't going to make it. So they called me, I was found. For many years, I was a little boy, I thought I was actually found. They had found me in the street, somebody dropped me in the street, and they picked me up and adopted me. Many years, I thought that's what they meant, Der Gefundener. I just want to make it to be a warning, the young parents, be careful what they say to their children. And that's the earliest memory of mine from Kovna. On the way to Israel, we passed through Slobodka, and we stayed with my uncle. At that time when I was sick, I was also in my uncle's house. See, my uncle was Reb Avrom Kozinski. He and my father were married to two sisters. I was born in 1930. Rebetzin Grodzinski, my aunt, she had died in 1929. And she had a one-year-old child, or a two-year-old child, who survived the war. He was in the camps, and he lives in Bnei Brak now, Yitzchak Grodzinski. And because he was a baby, so they brought him to live with us in Sitavian, in when his mother died in 1929. And he lived for several years in our house. Then when I was sick, they repaid me, and I stayed in my uncle, Rabbi Avraham Kozinski's house, when I was sick. So that's from Kovna to New York. We came in 1938. My father had come in 1937. We came a year later, and my father was the town, my father was Rav, more and more people moved away, and the salary couldn't be paid. When I arrived in Israel, when I got to Beit Vegan, as a matter of fact, I was paid a visit by someone who lived in Bnei Brak. I'm sorry, in Tel Aviv, Bernstein, Reb Chaim Bernstein. He wrote some Musaf's form and things like that.
Was a teacher in Echel HaTalmud.
Ken.
Echel HaTalmud is Shiva.
In Echel HaTalmud, he was what?
Mashgiach.
He was a Bar Mitzvah Sabbatka Talmud, and he came to visit me. And he said, thanks to me, you're alive. What? And he explained himself. The Reish HaKol in Tzitavian was a Jew by the family name of Shoham. In Russian, Shugam. Shoham. I pointed out that the many Lithuanian Jewish families had surnames from the Avnei HaChoshen, like Sapir or Barak, Aaron Barak. His father was Bereket, or Barkat, which is one of the stones, Bereket. was a rav. Let's say Rabbi Svei, Rabbi Elia Svei. His real name is Shvo. Shin Vav, one of the stones on the Choshen. How does a Litzak pronounce Shvo? Svei. That's one of the Avnei HaChoshen. And you look through the this affair. That Svei is the Avnei HaChoshen. So this person was Shoham. So he was a Reish HaKol. He had a store of cloth. Because then people sold their own clothes and so on. That's it. He had a store. He was the Reish HaKol. My father became Rav there in 1926. Yes.
What was the story about the post office?
Now that's later.
Oh, that's it. Okay.
Later. All right. Maybe I'll mention it. Anyways, in 1930, my father had been Rav there 4 years, and my father had spoken a shidduch to this Shoham's daughter, a bacher from Sabotke, by the name of Chaim Bernstein. And Chaim Bernstein moved to eat kist at his father-in-law's house in Tzitavyan. So there was this Sabotke Yeshiva bacher living in Tzitavyan. And this Chaim Bernstein came to speak to my father, and he said, his father-in-law wants to know, I'm sorry. My father-in-law asked him to ask his father. My father asked him to ask his father-in-law. My father asked this Chaim Bernstein, whom he had brought into Tzitavyan as a son-in-law of the Reish HaKol, ask your father-in-law if it's easy to raise my salary. They used to raise the salary every week. It was called the vocher. This is around collecting. Somebody used to give us a half a bread. Somebody used to give some coins. This is the way the Rav's salary was raised. So he says, find out from your father-in-law if it's easy to raise the vocher. So he said, why do you want to know? So he said, my father said, because I have an opportunity to go to a different shtetl, a bigger shtetl, where there'll be a bigger salary too. So if the tzibur here, the congregation, the community, doesn't find it hard to pay my salary, I'll stay here because here I don't have so many tildes on my head. Here I have more time to learn. I'll stay here. But if it's difficult, I'll take the other position. So he went to ask his father-in-law, and his father sent him back with the message, no problem. Stay here. A few years passed. It got already to 1935. Mr. Shoham and his son-in-law decide they're going to move to Israel, to Palestine then. All right. You see, this Bernstein, he died without children. He had a school to move to Eretz Yisrael for having children. So they decided they're going to move to Eretz Yisrael. As soon as they moved, there was no salary. There was hardly any money to my father. By that time, my father was looking for a different position. He couldn't get a different position. Why? Because he had grown children already. Any shtetl that he'll go become Rav will be obligated to marry off. He had an older sister. She was born in 1921. She was already 14 years old by 1935. He tried to get different rabbanis and he was unsuccessful. Therefore, when he already had accrued a debt to the grocer and to the butcher, there wasn't simply enough money to live on, so he decided he's going to go to America and become a mishulach for the Sabbatka Kailo. He'll get a certain percentage or a certain salary and have money to pay off the debts. And he intended to come back to Lithuania. As a matter of fact, later, when he decided he's going to stay, because Hitler marched him to Austria then, in March 1937, the Anschluss. And my father foresaw there's going to be a world war. because Hitler's appetite is insatiable. Now he's getting into Austria. Later he went into, or was it Czechoslovakia? It was before or later. Anyways, my father foresaw World War coming, and he knew how the German attitude toward Jews. So he said, I have to get my family out of Europe. At that time, his brother-in-law, Avraham Grodzinski, wrote to my father, you're going to take children and you're going to take them to America, to the Treifen and Medina, you're going to take them, what's going to happen to them? And he was convincing his sister-in-law, my mother, she should stay in Europe.
Yeah.
And my father wrote back, if my wife is not going to, the sister can't stay in Europe, I'm going to send her a get. This was my father's response. And then, so of course, she decided to go to America. But there's a question about my two older brothers, Rabbi Yamin and Rabbi Shmuel. My two older brothers, who were born in 1923 and 1925, respectively. There was a question that they should be left in Europe, because they're already bigger children. As a matter of fact, the younger one, Shmuel, became bar mitzvah while my father was in America. So my father used to say, my father felt his brother-in-law is right, he should leave them in Europe. But he just said he couldn't be separated like that from his children. But he always used to say, I don't know if I did the right thing. Very interesting. I don't know if I did the right thing. I think we have to end this year? Or the talk?
No, we have 20 minutes.
How much more?
20 minutes more.
20 minutes?
20, yeah.
Oh, all right. Because Rebbetzin and Shulman, who I mentioned earlier, once told me that people say about my father was very smart, very wise. So Rebbetzin Shulman said, this is something which is she was very wise. She said, you have to live long to find out if a person is wise. Because you have to see the ramifications of what he does. So it takes years and years before you find you conclude what it was that, if it was the right thing or not to do. Anyways, I would say the fact that my two older brothers survived the war, so my father was wise. Anyways, this Reb Chaim Bernstein said, the truth was that it was difficult to raise the salary for you. In 1930 already. And my father-in-law and myself decided we're going to lie to you. And we lied and we said it was easy because we didn't want you to go away from Tzitav Yam. If we would have told the truth, and you would have gone away from Tzitav Yam, you would have become a rov in some other little town in Lithuania, and the end would have been like with all the rabbanim in Lithuania, they were all killed out with the kehilas. So Rav Chaim Bernstein here in Vaitvagan told me, thanks to me that I lied, your family was saved. Now, someone mentioned the post office. From my shtetl, only one Jew survived. He was hidden out among, he remembered at least 22 different goyim, goyisha families that hid him out. And when this one survivor, his name was Yoshalezel Senzel. He was born in 1921. And he told me that my father asked him to learn when he was learning Chumash with one of my brothers, and he said, and he told me, and I knew about the Chumash better than your brother. This is what he told me. He came to Israel eventually. So he used to come and visit me every Purim when it was Purim in Yerushalayim. He lived in near Haifa when he came to Israel. So he'd come and visit me. So once I took him to Geula, there was I think it was his Purim he used to come. And his Purim used to come. So I took him to a store. There was a glazier at the corner of Yechezkel and Tzfanya. Remember there was a glazier there? I think there's a laundry now there. But there's a glazier there. This glazier was from Latvia. And he survived the war. He was in the camps and survived the war. So when I told him a Jew from Eichstätt was hidden out by going 22 different goyim, he said he's lying. There couldn't have been around one shtetl 22 good goyim. It's a year I'm lying. Next time he was in the, he visited me, I took this survivor to visit him, just to see. I want to tell you this, Yosha Lezel Zenzis, he didn't know how to say a lie. He didn't know how to say a lie. When he was telling me the way, see, when the Germans killed the men in the town, so he was working out of town. He was a carpenter already at that age. He was already 20 years old. He was a carpenter. So he was fixing windows by some guy in out on the farm. So then when he came back to the town, so he came back in a roundabout way, and he got there. All the Jews were, all the men, the women were still alive. So he says his mother told him, you have to hide out. So the first place he hid out was by a goy used to work for them. That also, I remember exactly, I was 8 years old. I remember exactly where he lived. When he came to visit me, my father came then to a wedding of my younger daughter, and she married a boy from America, so there wasn't much family except our family here for the wedding. So we made Shabbos Sherev Brachas in Tveria, and I invited the Senzalist to come from Haifa to be with us for Tveria. Well, my father met him, and he told my father who he is. So he says, Yesheres a Senzel, oh, you're Leiber the Fuhrmann's son. Leiber the Fuhrmann, because his father had a horse and wagon. That means the teamster. So he says, du bist Leiber the Fuhrmann's son. So yeah, anyways, I remember exactly where he lived. So then he began hiding out, and one family, so he told me that when his mother told him to go out of town and to find this place, this non-Jewish woman to hide out, so he took along a hoe. He took along a hoe, pretending, and actually a policeman rode past on the bike and said, what are you doing here? So he said, I was sent to fix up, because the railroad station was far, was about 2 kilometers out of town. I was sent to fix up the road over there. And when he told it over, so he let him go. So he told it over to me. So he says to me, he said, he's apologizing to me why he had to say a lie when he was carrying the hoe out there. I had to say that I was sent out there. He didn't know how to say a lie. And I want to tell you, when people speak about my father and never saying a lie, I want to tell you, there were many Jews in Lithuania who didn't say a lie. Everybody, you know, my father didn't say a lie. But in Lithuania, it wasn't so rare. Yeah, I'll tell you. Maybe when the all right, through everything my father went through, my brother and I used to say, your father showed that you can go through the world without lying. You can pass through that in 20 years without having to lie. Yeah, but so maybe that was the difficulty. But anyways. I went to visit Sitavyan in 1990. That was already after Bayit Fagan. I went to visit in 1990. Why? Because I was writing the book about my father. My father still had a sister in 1990. She was 98 years old then, living in Minsk. And I went to speak to her about my father's youth. I had no one else to speak to, how my father was as a young man. She was 2 years younger than my father. So in 1990, she was 98 years old. So from there, the family decided to give me a treat, and they drove 500 kilometers to the town of Sitavyan. Over there, I met the Jewish doctor who lived in Kelem. Kelem is the next town from Sitavyan. He was a Jewish doctor. He was working on behalf of the Russian government. Then he was in charge of the health department for the county where Sitavyan was. So I contacted him, and he came to Sitavyan to meet me there. And I asked him, take me into somebody who was here during the war. So he took me into an old non-Jewish woman, and he served as a translator. And I asked her about a story my father used to say after the war. This is the question that you raised. My father used to say that when he first came to Tzitavyan, the first question that someone came to ask him was, a Jew said, I bought some stamps in the post office, and the postman gave me too much change. Do I have to return it? I have to return it. My father told him to return it. My father told him, maybe I'll put it in, you don't. But he'll make a cheshma at the end of the day. He gave him a $10 bill, he'll figure how much is missing to him. You give it back. Well, my father went to the post office a couple of weeks later to buy for himself. The postman gave him too much change too. Then he realized what it was. The postman was testing the Rav. So the first time he tested him by giving the extra change, he figured that person was going to ask his Rav what to do. Because the guy used to ask their Lahavdol, their priest. So he figured he's going to ask Rav. And then the postman figured that maybe if I'll check the Rav himself, I'll give him the extra change, maybe he'll pocket it. So my father, of course, right away returned it. And my father said, it could be that after when the war broke out, I heard that the postman saved Jews. The postman saved Jews. It could be that the postman, because he saw how Jews act, and you have to return the Aveda of a Goy, if it's a Kiddush Hashem, he saw how Jews act, so therefore he was sympathetic to the Jews and he helped save Jews. When this Senzulis first met me, I asked him, my father says a story about the postman that he saved Jews. Is that true? So he said, the postman was like everybody else. What do you mean he saved Jews? He used to come in the good days, he used to come to drink whiskey with us on Simchas Torah. In Lithuania, not only on Purim do people get drunk on Simchas Torah too, which is a very interesting thing. You can write a paper about it. Yeah. Why is it? Well, they also imbibed. Anyways, but he did like everybody else. So I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand it. My father said that he held Jews. Then later I figured out. The only Jew in Tzitavyan that was saved was Senzulis. But a few days earlier, before the women were killed, the Rebbetzin of Tzitavyan, my father's Memali Mokom, the one who became Rav after my father left, he, of course, the Rav himself was killed even before the rest of the men. First they took a number of men, they sent them off to Rasein, to the large city, and they were all killed there. Before they killed all the men of the town. So the Rebbetzin Medin, her family name was Medin, she fled to Shavel, that's a big city, where there was a ghetto. So I think that my father she also survived. Their children were killed there in the ghetto with all the other children that were rounded up and killed eventually. But she survived. My father found this out, could be through her, that the postman must have warned her what the plans are to kill out the Jews and when they're supposed to be killed out. And therefore, she fled, or maybe even helped her flee to Shavuot. That's why my father, on that basis, my father said that the postman helped Jews. When I came in 1990, so I asked this translator, ask her if she remembers who the postmen were. She says, yes, Kozlovsky, and that was the name my father used. Kozlovsky used to stand in the post office, and another postman used to go out and deliver the mail. There were two postmen. The Kozlovsky was on. So I asked her, did Kozlovsky, was he good to Jews? I asked her that. A good to Jews? So she started crying, and she said, Everybody from our generation was good to Jews. It was the young people. They had the guns, and they're the ones who killed. And that was a fact, that the young people, they became the German, they used to listen to the German radio. They incited them, and they were also became more nationalistic. But the plain elderly goyim, so I'm not surprised that there were so many who took that chance to hide a Jew. But he remembers 22 different ones, because after a family would keep him for a little bit, they would continue on and so on. Now I know my time is running out, so I'm just going to end with something people have asked me. This is all called Volume 1. The next volume is supposed to cover from about 1908 till 1937, when my father leaves Europe for America. Now, I'm not getting any younger either, and this, the effect that this book had on me and my family was not too helpful. But I want to tell you something. The same as Rebbes and Shulman told me things which have gone to the grave with her. My brother-in-law, Rabbi Shurin, my oldest sister's husband, he has died, and it'll be 2 years before Pesach. You'll find him as a source for many things in the book. And I just met this week Reb Chaim Sarna. He was also a good source. You'll find him many times. And I met him this week at a wedding, and I see he's already not so reliable as he used to be. Anyways, from this period of 1908 to 1937, I really feel that I have a chayv kodosh to write about Tzitav Yam. Who else will write about my martyred native town? And as long as my older siblings are still here to advise me and to guide me and to tell me things that they remember which I was too young to appreciate, I think the time is for me to write about Tzitav Yam. I'll have to skip, in the meantime, from 1908 to 1926, when my father became rough, and I continue from 26 to 37, Bli Neder. Look out for the book which will be called Ode to Tzitav Yam.